This afternoon, what I'd like to do is kind of a bifocal thing, dually purposed. And let me say as a caveat, I fully recognize that a number of those present may not belong to the Baptist tribe of the church, but I hope that will be beside the point, because what I am going to talk about for a few minutes is some discoveries from world preaching. It happens to be a survey of Baptist world preaching, but in much of the Christian world, it would not differ from a great deal of the other preaching, particularly where the church is finding itself in great growth. I was asked by a commission of the Baptist World Alliance to bring a report on Baptist preaching in 2011 worldwide. And in order to do that, I solicited sermons from the six regions that are used by BWA to define world Baptist. And that is, obviously, Europe and North America, South America, Africa, Caribbean, Asia, Pacific Rim. In order to select the sermons, I asked respected leaders in each of those to nominate some names, and I came up with four names for each of those six regions. We're going to enlarge that before we do a book. And then asked them if they would submit the sermon they wanted to submit. No parameters were given, no definitions were advanced. It would just submit the sermon that you would like to submit as representative of your preaching, and then we waited to see what would happen. Now, commenting on anybody's sermons in a selection is a chancy and dicey venture that rests somewhere between commenting on who a newborn most looks like in the family and raising political questions at an extended family holiday meal. I don't know how it is in your extended family. We do not get into that. Discreet silence at both times proves to be a safe course. Taste in sermons remains as varied as taste for goose liver pate on the one hand and sushi on the other. There's just no accounting for taste. And you know that. If you ask people, would you please recommend a great preacher? You don't get the same thing from everybody. In Baptist life, the attempt to comment on sermons is dodgier still. Preaching stands as much at the center of Baptist life as the pulpit stands in the middle of the altar or the stage or the platform, depending on what part of the Baptist world you inhabit. To comment on Baptist preaching is to comment on the heart of Baptist life. Now, I also had to look at these confessedly with the a priori that I am a white North American Baptist male and have blind spots and lacunae that I'm not aware of. I think when we're looking at preaching, we need to keep that in mind, at front of mind, that our lens looking at preaching can give us myopia, can give us tunnel vision, because we're looking at preaching through a lens. So I tried in every way to keep that front of mind in looking at these world sermons and hope that it helped me. Now, the attempt to comment on 24 sermons as a collection was daunting. And let me just say a few things I found, and I hope these would provoke some discussion, not just about world preaching, but about our preaching. In the brief overview that I gave summarizing these sermons, and the sermons ran 150 pages, and my overview ran 70 pages, I attempted to identify the sermons first as whether they're preached to insiders or outsiders. That is the Baptist world pulpit primarily speaking to those in the church or speaking either to seekers or those who need evangelistic or charismatic preaching outside? And then I looked at the occasions. These people could send them in from any time they wanted to. What was the occasion, the venue? Then I looked at the major styles. Were they deductive, inductive, narrative, or something else? Then I looked at the kind of hackneyed, shop-worn, but still vital categories. Was this pastoral, evangelistic, doctrinal, ecclesial, or was it institutional Were they speaking to the church about being the church? Cleo LaRue says one of the major divisions of preaching is institutional preaching. Speaking to the church is an institution. You do have one. First time you get a $5,000 light bill, you know you've got one. It's an institution. Now, and then how are the texts distributed in the canon? Let me say just a little bit about what I found from surveying Baptist preaching in the world right now. Now, 20 of the 24 sermons, to my surprise, spoke to those inside the faith. I had a feeling in looking at World Baptist preaching that there would be a great deal of preaching to outsiders. Actually, only one sermon, a sermon by an African pastor, Reverend Olukoi, spoke explicitly in what we would call an evangelistic idiom. I think if many people were stereotyping Baptist preaching, we might think that worldwide it would primarily be evangelistic. I found only one of these sermons exclusively evangelistic. Now, three of them spoke to outsiders. Adamola Eshola is the most respected Baptist leader in Nigeria, which incidentally has 10,000 Baptist churches, second only to the United States. Eshola preached at the birthday party of the governor of one of those states, and on his 60th birthday, with all of the Nigerian government present, sounded like Amos on steroids. I've never read such a sermon spoken face to face to government leaders. It was Amos-like. I asked Dr. Eshola, how did you get out? And he said, quickly. Reverend Hall Johnson spoke to the national culture of Jamaica at the time of National Celebration of Emancipation. He talked about the Jamaica that was and the Jamaica that could be. And then Akwakol presented the only sermon in Africa that was explicitly evangelistic. Now, this raises a question for them, for Baptists worldwide: to whom do we primarily preach? It's old, it's true, though. C.H. Dodd divided New Testament materials into what two big divisions? Didache and what? Kerygma. That is instruction for those inside and the charismatic proclamation of the gospel to those outside. Categories are still valid. Most Baptist preaching in this world collection in 2011 is didache. It's instruction to those inside. Maybe one message by Reverend Agiboyan of Africa stands it's kind of on a borderline between Christology for those inside the church and those outside the church. Half of the sermons, and this was interesting, that were submitted, and they could have submitted anything they wanted, were sermons submitted for special occasions. Leads me to believe that Baptists still put a lot of weight on sermons preached at special occasions. And Opranov of Bulgaria sent me his sermon preached at the 400th anniversary of Baptist. Vandeleer of Amsterdam did the same thing. Others at National Regent, Steve Asante, preached a sermon on the retirement of Adamola Eshola in Nigeria. Asante's from Ghana, Adamola's from Nigeria. Dr. N of Myanmar preached a philosophical world religion message to Baptists gathered in Myanmar. Dr. West preached at the EK Bay. Othonio Jose Sepulveda Torres spoke to the National Baptist Congress in Chile. And incidentally, inside these institutional sermons, I came to see that World Baptists by no means share the same polity. In that sermon, Othniel Sepulveda Torres said, the pastor constitutes the church. Now, if you say that in our neck of the woods, you may be looking for a church. But he stated in that convention in Chile, the pastor constitutes the church. That's almost patristic sounding, isn't it? Where the bishop is, the church is. I'm going to comment on some other reasons why these do not have a unity of ecclesiology. Two of the sermons directly reference liturgical occasions. George Mason up in Dallas on Transfiguration Sunday, and Peter Holmes in Canada, in Toronto, speaking in a Lenten series. Two preachers speak directly to concerns at a specific local churches. Henlon preached a dedicatory sermon for a church in Jamaica, and Simon Coralagi, a preacher introduced to me by Dr. Michael Stroop of our faculty, sent in, of all things, a funeral sermon for a young Sinhalese Christian in Sri Lanka, one of the most moving sermons in the collection. Interesting thing to send in for a collection of sermons. But the other half of the sermons, interestingly, could have preached almost any time or anywhere. The sermon submitted by John Piper could have been printed in any century of the Christian church, and you wouldn't have known what century it was. He preached a sermon on John's use of the Old Testament to witness to Jesus. I read Piper's sermon, and there was not one venue-specific word in it, not a single contemporary illustration. It could have been preached at any time in Christian history. Now, much of the debate in mainline Protestant preaching has been for years a debate among deductive, inductive, or narrative. Now, here's something not debatable in this collection of 24 worldwide Baptist sermons, four from each region in six regions. 18 out of the 24 were deductive in their style, which was a surprise to me. The other eight were not. I think this underscores the Baptist inclination in world preaching for sermons that are didactic or instructive. I was surprised worldwide at how denotative, aggressively denotative and didactic Baptist preaching is. For those of us who hang around areas where it's more evocative, indirect, suggestive, artistic, we might be surprised to find how directively denotative and didactic most world Baptist preaching is. Come back and talk about that in a minute. Deductive preaching in 18 out of the 24. And that's interesting in light of the Academy's almost univocal criticism in the United States of deduction as preaching that will not be heard today. Yet one-third of the sermons demonstrate a narrative or inductive approach. However, of those, they're nearly all in Europe or North America. It's interesting. Norma Blythe of Regent's Park College in her sermon follows inductively a sermon on tradition. Tivolo Pili, an outstanding preacher in Estonia, has a scintillating narrative sermon talking about uses of power in that former Soviet bloc country in the persona of Jesus and Pilate. A fantastically inventive sermon. Van der Leer narrates Baptist history. George Mason aesthetically narrates the beauty of the Transfiguration, and Tanya Vickery in North Carolina narrates the lectionary text from Psalm 116, 1 Peter 1, for Mother's Day, of all things. Now, three other sermons that are narrative deserve comment. Dr. Coralagi, a preacher in Sri Lanka, brought a comforting funeral sermon narrative intertwining the death of this Sinhalese young man and John 11. Jacome of Ecuador narrates the cost of faith in the life of that country, and Hall narrates an engaging tale that sobers us at the cost of discipleship in his country. Now, what about the intent of these sermons? And they were gathered, come what may. Two of them were devotional. Only one was evangelistic. Five were what I would call pastoral. Six were doctrinal. Two were ethical. The biggest category was a surprise to me, ecclesial institutional. That is, telling the church how to be the church in that location. Far more than I would have expected in submitted sermons. Now, what about the texts that were chosen? Well, it shouldn't be a big surprise that 20 out of the 24 were from the New Testament. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise. Only four were from Hebrew Scripture. In the New Testament, since these were Baptists, do you think that either gospel or epistle predominated? Epistle. In fact, interestingly, of the great deeds of Jesus in the synoptic gospels, not a single one of them made any of these sermons, which was arresting to me when you take 24 World Baptist sermons in one collection. Mention of the Transfiguration in one of them, but that was not a mighty work in nature or healing or exorcism or resurrection. So there's a tendency in World Baptist preaching to be overwhelmingly New Testament and inclined toward gospel. One other thing I want to say about it, and then I'd like to make some observations, have some question and answer. In trying to find a way to measure these, I decided to use a measure from John McClure at Vanderbilt in which he takes the four codes of preaching. One of them is what he calls the scriptural code. How do you use the Holy Bible? Overwhelmingly, World Baptists use it in a simple, devotional translation mode. Here's what I mean. If you're preaching on Mary, Martha, and Jesus, and you preach in a translation code, you're saying, Mary was at the feet of Jesus in Bethany, so too today we ought to wait at the feet of Jesus. That's just translation. From that to here. For example, and I don't have time to go into this at length, if you get behind that text, standing behind it, you would say this was a revolutionary act on the part of an itinerant male rabbi to go into the home of two women and teach them? Unheard of. That's standing behind the text. Most Baptist world preaching is simply, here's the nowness of the thenness. In terms of the semantic code, whether it's indirect and evocative or whether it's denotative, I've already said it. Most of these sermons are in an explicitly denotative voice. But then you get to something more subtle. And that's what McClure calls the theosymbolic code. That is, how does God look in these sermons? If you look at the whole sermon, how's God look? Is he powerful and triumphal, or is he up against it, and we don't know quite how it's going to come out. In Baptist world preaching, God and Jesus, as they are symbolized in the sermons, are powerful, strong, they're in a fight, but they are going to win. That's over against sermons that have a low view of the outcome. Baptist view, it's a fight, but God wins in the end. Now the last thing, how does culture get used? And by that I mean illustrations. When they bring stuff into sermons, how do Baptist preachers in the world bring it in from popular culture, from lived experience? Now there's four ways to do that primarily in preaching. One is to identify faith with culture. I mean in that regard, just to be painfully explicit. That's what the late D. James Kennedy did when he identified the American experiment with Christianity. Here's what Pat Robertson does. It's faith equals culture. Or the dialectical use of culture. That is, one piece of culture touches on one piece of Bible. Or there's the sectarian use of culture. And that is the only time I use culture is to drag it in the sermon and beat it up. That bunch of gambling, beer drinking, whatever, you know. The only thing I bring it in is just to beat it up. And then there is the dualist use of culture, and that is, I don't talk about it at all. The church is in one realm, and the contemporary world is in another, and they never touch. Now, it's interesting in these sermons, the overwhelming use of culture is dialectical. And that is, they don't identify faith and culture. They don't identify nationalism and Christianity. Nobody does that. But they do say this piece of culture, art, music, pop culture, my life, gets brought into this sermon to shed light on this piece of Scripture. It's what McClure calls the dialectical use of culture. Now, there's one or two of them that beat culture up pretty good, but for the most part, it is dialectical. They bring in a slice of life in order to do it. I think of one particular sermon in this series by the leading Baptist preacher in Australia. He's been knighted. He's a member of the Order of something in Australia. And he has a national radio program in Australia, a call-in talk show. And I felt like in his sermon, as much as any other sermon, he used contemporary Australian culture, Clifford, as a way to get heard in his preaching. He teaches it to Moorling Theological College. His entire message was using cultural images from Australia, known to his secular audience, to pull them into the gospel without identifying faith with culture. Well, short of reading you all these sermons, which I don't think I'll do this afternoon, 150 pages of them, I've tried to give you an overview, and I had no idea what to expect about this. I kind of expected I'd get a whole lot of evangelistic and missionary messages. I didn't. I didn't expect the amount of didactic, linear structure in the message I got. I didn't expect, on the other hand, some of the creative sermons from where I got them. Opronov in Bulgaria, an incredibly inventive and creative sermon by a preacher I'd never heard of, Pedro Opronov. Poivotili, they're in Estonia. I mean, Estonian Baptists are not someone we often call to mind, and it may be the best sermon in the whole collection. Well, hear a few words about Baptist preaching worldwide, about choice of text, deductive, inductive, narrative, inside or outside. How do you use illustrations in culture? And my intent of this was to kind of put this out here, not to continue to dissect Baptist world preaching, but for us to talk about preaching some more right here in our neck of the woods, bouncing it off of those discoveries about Baptist world preaching. Why are we like it? How are we not like it? What is it? So, I've been talking, I feel like, for 3 days right now, Dr. Glore. I'd like to open this up. Some of you had questions you next door, at lunch. Others of you might find some things provoked by things I've said about this overview of world preaching by preachers who don't know one another by and large, and who randomly sent these sermons in to reflect Baptist preaching worldwide 2011 globally. So, somebody asked something. I know somebody had a question left over from inside. We'll go from there as long as you wish. Adam has a mic. Adam Horton has a mic, and this is your opportunity to be recorded on the Truett Media Archive for all the ages. Okay. Right here.
Yes, I was going to ask, did you explore if the sermons had like multiple layers in them, like preaching to different educational levels?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you looked at?
Did I explore whether they had multiple layers in them, and that is addressed to different levels? Yes. And not to be simplistic about it, but the sermons in the third world where the church is exploding, where growth is most vital, and that is in Africa and South America, The sermons there tended to connect with more people in the congregations. Quite frankly, the European sermons and the North American sermons were far more cerebral. They weren't textured as much as the sermons in those countries where, from my perspective, the tomorrow of the Christian faith is headed in the Browning of Christianity. And they tended to connect with more people and to be more explicit and more denotative than the European and North American. You got a sense in the European sermons particularly that we know all these stories and we're mining them from a different mine shaft. We're trying to sink probes into the scripture that's different from what we all already know. And that's not a value judgment. It's just what's happening. All right? Okay.
Thanks, Adam. How frequent was it obvious that the sermon writers were using historical critical methodologies?
Okay.
And was that just confined to Europe and North America?
Okay. No, it wasn't. The question was, how frequent did they use historical critical tools? I would say the predominant use of those tools was in Europe and North America, but Dr. N, his name E.N., in Myanmar, used to be Burma. Obviously, not only was a sophisticated exegete, but also a world religions interpreter in his sermon. Koralagi, pastored First Baptist in Kuala Lumpur. More of the same. Now, I did find a good deal of standing what I would call in front of the text rather than behind it in areas where the church is exploding. Now, when you talk about historical, critical, analytical tools, that to me leads to preaching standing behind the text, that is looking into it for what's not obvious on the surface. I found in the areas where the church is exploding, preachers tended to stand in front of the text and bring things in a trajectory from what they're facing in compelling church growth back to the text. So the trajectory in those areas is the situation right in front of them carrying that to the text. So it was an interesting bifurcation in that regard. I would say on the whole, these sermons demonstrate what I would call a grammatical, historical exegesis of the text. Etymology, context, grammar, syntax. Certainly not worldwide is Baptist preaching overt in the pulpit about what we might consider more substantial or fulsome uses of historic critical method. That's not that it's not there. It's just, I think, that not all of them try to translate it into the idiom of the pulpit where they're preaching. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes, sir. You know, Billy Leonard, Dr. Billy Leonard, from Wake, stood at this very pulpit a while back and defined Baptist. Dr. Leonard said, Baptists are people who believe in the priesthood of the believer with the necessity of dissent. and that's about what I found. That's a good question. You know, brother, I need to go back and read them with that view. I can say this after living with them for months. I can't think of anything that just sounds overwhelmingly Baptist other than that they're biblical, which is a Baptist distinctive, but that doesn't belong to Baptist alone. Now, let me tell you in this regard two things I found in a significant number of these sermons I didn't expect to find. And that was, in the developing world, how much emphasis the prosperity gospel has. And it comes in the sermons in two ways. Some of them are trying to fight them and lick them, and some of them have already joined them. And kin to that is another thing, and some of you have to help me. I talked to Dr. Olson about one of our theologians here, Dr. Roger Olson, who came out of a Pentecostal background, has a PhD from Rice. This word of power language, speak a word of power into your situation. That is showing up in Baptist preaching worldwide. For any of us who have an ear attuned to the native Baptist tongue, that's not native Baptist idiom. Reverend Hagin. Some of y'all are shaking your head. You familiar with Reverend Hagin? Speak a word of power. Now, I found this dropping down right into some of the, and you ask yourself, well, how did this get there? By book, by radio, by some kind of evangelical jet stream that carries it, conferences, conventions. Those were two things that were very present in sermons, particularly in Africa and South America. Either confronting the prosperity gospel, nobody confronted the word of power movement. Several of these sermons just said, speak a word of power, as if in my speaking it, it brings it to pass. Walking around your question, I found that to be distinctly those two things, un-Baptist, importing a triumphalistic theology from elsewhere. But man, you get the feeling a lot of wrestling going on with the prosperity gospel.
Sir, if you would please expound on the difference between deductive and narrative preaching and any other preaching style that you would like to make mention of.
All right. It's a very good question. We throw these words around the academy that are really kind of inside baseball talk. Not one church member more than 100 in the pew is sitting there saying, well, this is an inductive sermon today. The pastor's being deductive today. No, they're not talking about that. So it's inside baseball. It's tags we put on things to talk about what we do. So first of all, that's the angle of vision, okay? I'm not fooled. Lay folks have two categories of sermons, I'm absolutely persuaded. Good and bad. They do. I mean, they're not dealing with theosymbolic codes and narratives. Good or bad. Or some of my friends say, can he say it? Yeah. Now, deductive is that style of preaching which moves from general to particular. Deductive preaching in its classical plot, right up at the beginning of the sermon, says, here is what I'm going to talk about. Usually in a present tense, active voice, declarative sentence. It's just out there. You know, if you're preaching from the healing of the leper, Luke 5, a deductive big idea might be, Jesus is always more contagious than anybody who touches him. That's the big idea. Now, you're going to develop that by little pieces that support that. Jesus is always approachable. Jesus is full of compassion. Jesus doesn't leave you the way he found you. On and on and on. It's little pieces that support that big statement. Now, inductive preaching, to some degree, turns that upside down. It's little piece, little piece, little piece, little piece. Piece of scripture, piece of lived experience. Here, here, here. And the master of that, Fred Craddock, puts in his textbook, he puts it so well, he says, when you come to the end of the sermon, you don't know whether, the congregation doesn't know whether you said it or they thought it. That is, it expects the congregation to do more work. Deductive, I say that hands the homiletic football off to the congregation on the 10-yard line. It says, here, you carry it the rest of the way in. Inductive is a lateral on about the 40-yard line. And it says, I've tried to help you get this thing down the field. Now here, you go the rest of the way. And it kind of, you know, and then, well, narrative, some people, to me, as a separate category, it could blend with either one of those and some other things. I'm one who believes you can have deductive narrative preaching. Inside a deductive structure that's not heavy-handed, you can predominantly narrate the text. Inductive certainly lends itself to that. And I talked in the other room a moment ago about narrative, and we could go on and on about it. Ways of doing it, according to Gene Lowry, one is just run the story. Just tell the biblical story in a cogent way. Up here in the Kyle Lake Center, we have the VCR of Haddon Robinson that was recorded when he was named by Baylor in 1997 as one of the outstanding preachers in the English-speaking world. The whole sermon is just a vivid telling of the David, Bathsheba, Uriah story. Just incredibly good. You ever get a chance to look at that, you won't know how to do just running the story. He's told the story. Now, another way of doing narrative is initially to give some contemporary problem, some problem in the pew, you name it, and then attach to it a biblical narrative. Obviously, the other is the reverse of that. Tell a biblical story, and then at the end, nail it to the now. Pin it to the practical in some problem that's out there in the pew or in life. Now, a fourth way is alternative narrative, which is really, to me, what used to be called a homily, and that is talk about a biblical story, then, now. It's kind of a homiletical sandwich. You talk about the story a little bit, then-ness. You talk about where it fits into nowness. I mentioned Haddon Robinson. Haddon's interesting. He's an old dog who's learned new tricks. 81 years of age, he's more or less quit on what was his strong point, and that is big idea deductive preaching, has become a narrator. They're great narrative sermons. The sermon on the rich fool who needed bigger barns. He starts, in a sense, in nowness. Haddon says, well, there he is in his study after dinner. He has the blueprints for barns on his desk. There on the wall, three plaques. One, Farmer of the Year for Bethlehem, A.D. 30. Second, Farmer of the Year for all Judea, A.D. 31. Then another plaque, bigger, Farmer of the Year, Middle East. Man like that needs new barns. Well, you know that he, you know, anybody with much imagination knows he didn't have that on the wall. It's nowness, and then he'll dip back into the text and then back into a knock on his door. He looks at his Outlook Express. He doesn't have an appointment right now. And it's a brilliant weaving of then-ness and nowness in alternative narrative, which I think may work as well as any of them in a narrative structure. Now, narrative depends on being able to tell a story, and most preachers have got enough blarney in them to be able to tell some stories. I mean, it's just a storytelling profession. If you can't tell a story, you may want to work on it. Storytelling. Listen to some great storytellers. Listen to them. Yeah, look, I get old Garrison Keillor. Man, listen to Garrison Keillor tell stories. Mary Home Companion. Somebody who's a good raconteur that will help you with narrative. Listen to some great narrative preachers. That is something that I'm convinced can hardly be taught, but can be learned if you get exposed to narration. Now, let me say the downside of it. And this isn't just my opinion. Some weaknesses, like in any of these methodologies, deductive, some weaknesses are coming out. And that is people who for decades have listened to narrative preaching have not necessarily been able to put together what they believe. They've heard a lot of good stories. But when you ask them, what do you believe about the person and work of Jesus Christ? That kind of question. That's not a question that kind of fits the frame of what they've heard. And it's been observed that some churches that hear only narration have a hard time with inchoate questions. What do you believe about this? And that's not to trash it. It's just to say that just as deduction has its limitations, there are some in narrative as well. Does that help you any, brother? Lay this out. You know, I sometimes if I ever say a good word about deduction, I feel like a Luddite or a Flat Earth Society member. But I am convinced that the main thing wrong with deduction is how much boring, predictable deduction there's been. It doesn't have to be that way. Okay? Somebody else? Dr. Gore said I had to go so long. So
Dr. Gregory, some of these churches, other countries, deal with what would some people call the other. They're in the middle of other faiths. They're around, you know, other religions. Do any of those sermons address the church in Christianity as in that environment of other religions, other faiths?
Or as I heard, if I heard your question correctly, and if you've got a church that's in a pluralistic environment, religiously, how do you address that? Well, in this collection of sermons, the sermon by Dr. N, he spells his name E-N, in Myanmar, formerly Burma, was among the very best at that. He took a history of religions approach in that pluralistic country, and in a way that I always attach to E. Stanley Jones and his Christ of the Indian Road, that may date me a little, but it's a great book, even though it's been around a while. In a lick 'em or join 'em attitude, he wants to join 'em. He makes a case that the Christian faith in Myanmar is the fulfillment of the longings and aspirations of these other faiths in a pluralistic country. And he does a brilliant job of it. He's not antagonistic, but rather in a kind of history of religion, scale of values approach. He acknowledges the worthiness, if you would, of the other faiths in the context of Myanmar/Burma, and shows how Jesus, in Jesus, is the fulfillment of the highest aspiration of all of these. Which, to my way of thinking, for the most part, is what's going to work in that kind of pluralism, rather than just smash mouth taking them on, with possibly, and I'm just putting this out here, with possibly one exception. I don't know if that's absolutely true about Islam for this reason. I was visiting Kensington Temple, the largest evangelical church in London now, thousands of people. They minister all of the time to Islamic people in London. And the pastor there said, if we take a concessive approach, and they debate them at Hyde Park Corner, they debate them in neighborhoods where there's Sharia law. They say, if we take a concessive approach, so we don't even get their attention. They said they appreciate it if we come straight at them. Here's what we believe. Now, I'm not saying I'm a rank amateur about that. It's very interesting to me, somebody right on the battlefront in a city with untold Islamic population saying, no, the way we get them to hear us is not concession. It is stating in their face what Christians believe or they will not respect us. Of course, they do some things too, and that's a Elam church. Anybody familiar with that, Kensington Temple? What we call in the United States Foursquare Gospel Church, the biggest evangelical church in London. Now, they do things that we Baptists don't much try. They go into Islamic communities, ask them to bring their sick, put them up on the stage, and ask Jesus to heal them. And sometimes he does, and when they do, they got a whole lot of sudden converts right then. Now, that's different stuff from what we do, but but they're doing it. What are you going to say? You're not doing it? But they say, I don't know, I don't run around your question, but concession, but that may be an exception of concession. Maybe somebody wants to debate that. I don't know. Somebody else? Any other questions about preaching? Yes, sir.
You mentioned that in Africa and in Latin America, was where you found much of the prosperity-type gospel. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a reflection of the context the people live in, or do you think that is more a reflection of the reach? I always think of the prosperity gospel as kind of America-centric kind of teaching. Is that reflective of America's reach down into South America? Because their conditions there, for the most part, don't reflect much prosperity.
No,
is it hopeful to them?
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't look like a reality of their existence.
Yeah. All I could give you in that regard is pure speculation. I don't think that that's a plant that natively grows in South American and African soil. I think it's a transplant. I think it's a transplant because of international media. I don't think that it would have organically grown out of the soil of Africa or South America. Now, granted what you said, the conditions of hopelessness there give that plant some fertilization, but I think it's a transplant. It is a regrettable export. And I could name the names. I won't name the names. If I name the names, you'd know the names. You'd recognize the names because it's the same crew here that are on television, they're watching there, that are promising the same things they promise here. You know, I was preaching on a program in the United States just a few months ago. Somehow I got on it with a prosperity preacher, stood up in front of 1,000 people and said, God has told me there will be 10,000 new billionaires in America in 2011, and 100 of them are here tonight. I was hoping I was one of them. I didn't know. Now, and I mean that, and I have to say this, these were thoughtful people in what I would call a traditional Baptist church who sat there and listened to that as seriously as if it were an oracle from God himself. That's what we're, and that's that when you export that, I don't think that's a plant that grows natively in those soils. I hope that gets at, and that's my speculation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, very, very different. The Jose Sepulveda Torres, the Chilean preacher, the Ecuadorian preacher, the Myanmar preacher, Dr. Koch at First Baptist Kuala Lumpur, all of them are very explicit in not presenting a triumphalistic Christianity. And that is, we're already in the millennium, the battle is won. You can tell in those venues that they are in a fight for the faith. Now, in the way they talk about God, in the theosymbolic code, it's what McClure calls low positive. That means, yes, God will win, but not without a real struggle here, versus a kind of triumphalistic, almost realized millennium preaching. That is really, in a sense, what the prosperity gospel is.
Dr. Gregory, I had a couple of questions. First of all, where could we see this report? Mm-hmm. Are the texts of the sermons in your report? Mm-hmm. And then I guess that I want to depart from it and ask you about your sermon notes that I asked you at lunch today about whether you use a manuscript or handwritten or whatever.
Thank you for asking. First of all, according to Dr. Kerry Newman, who's the publisher for Baylor Press, This is all embargoed until it comes out in the book. So it will be in the Baylor Press book that will be all of the sermons, plus some more we're collecting, plus introductory words, and then a chapter final conclusion. Now, the other question was... Okay. All right, yes, we talk about it in notes, and that is the bedeviling question, what do you write and what do you take to the pulpit with you? I think that's kind of it, right? Well, that's as individuals the DNA of a preacher. I write a full manuscript. Every sermon I preach, last night, this morning, every word of it, generally about 6 pages, single space. But it is what has been called an oral manuscript. I never speak it, write it, and then say it. I say it and then write it. Now, that's not original to me at all. Goes back, my homiletician taught me, and Clyde Fant said that. There's a difference in essays and oral speech. And I like to tell my students, some of you here have heard me say it, study out loud. I read exegesis out loud. And I start preaching to nobody in particular, right in the middle of it. You never know when a sermon's going to be born. I think, and I differ here from Paul Scott Wilson, a wonderful Canadian homiletician, I agree with him, and I agree with Paul Wilson. I disagree with what Fred Craddock says. Fred Craddock says, let your study of the text be one thing, but that is separate. You put that down, and then you think, here's how I'm going to say it. In his book on preaching, he wants to make a clear delineation between study, that's getting the stuff, the facts, Joe Friday, just the facts, you know, and then how am I going to say it? Paul Scott Wilson, a very warm-hearted member of the Church of Canada, teaches in Toronto, written a number of books on preaching, God's Sense, the text, and so forth. Paul says, no, we shouldn't look at getting ready to preach like being on the exegetical bus, and then you hand a transfer slip over to the hermeneutical bus, and then you hand another transfer slip over to the homiletical bus. Like the way, it's a very creative way of saying it. He said, no, all three conversations need to be going on the same bus. And I agree with that. The moment anything strikes me in a text that might preach, I start preaching it right then. You know, scares the dog, my wife's used to it, you know. But I do. Out loud, because I'm going to be saying it out loud. So I would agree with the approach. I have a full manuscript, but it's a manuscript that comes from saying it out loud several times, then writing it down for refinement and precision of language, okay, to capture it. Now, in terms of what you take to the pulpit, that's as varied as... There's some great manuscript preachers. Some of the greatest preachers in America, overwhelmingly great preachers. Dr. Charles Adams, the so-called Harvard Hooper, tremendous preacher in Detroit, full manuscript. A man we had here, William Curtis, full manuscript preacher from Mount Ararat in Pittsburgh. I could name preachers of many denominations. The question is, to state the obvious, are you preaching to a piece of paper or are you preaching to people? If your engagement is with a piece of paper, it creates material distance from people. Now, I found that the effective manuscript preachers somehow leave the illusion, I don't know how they do it, that they are looking at people. But if you are totally engaged with something down, you know, it just doesn't, you know. It's kind of a poor old joke. It's a sad, you have to forgive it. You know, the preacher who wanted to act like he didn't have any notes. You know, this is so old it's new, I think. But he said, God created a man, and his name was Adam. He pinned him inside him. He went on about Adam a while. He had his notes. He said, and then he found a companion for Adam, and her name was Eve. it on a while and said, and then God blessed them. God blessed them with a son. His name was Brooks Brothers. Oh, no, that's my suit. And we've all had stuff like that. But, that kind of stuff, if you use a manuscript, has got to be avoided. I mean, if you say something, the most significant thing in this message is Jesus, On the other hand, you ask, my own habit is this, write a full manuscript, preach it out loud. I've been building it from the bottom up, from the beginning. I don't have to memorize it. I put it together one brick at a time. Then make a few mnemonic notes to take to the pulpit. You looked at my notes, say from this morning or last night, nobody could read them but me. They're almost encrypted cues about what's next. But I don't make a fetish out of it. Some have made a fetish out of preaching without notes. Well, if you got a bad sermon without notes, it might be better with them. There's no fetish about not having a note. If you're better with them, I'd take some. But try to look at people when you preach to them. That's my goal. That's not rocket science. Try to look at people. You're preaching to people, not to a piece of paper. And look at individual people. Even if you're manuscript people, don't look back at the back wall. I see some preachers look like they're looking at a teleprompter in the air. No, look at people, real individuals. People in a congregation can even tell if you're looking between them. Hook up with them. And sometimes, what kind of, look at the people who encourage you. Don't look at the other group. I mean, all of us have people who sit there, well, just give me your best shot. Don't look at them. Don't look at them. I mean, this, look at the people who encourage you. Thank God. Isn't it true that he's put people out in every congregation that look like hungry little birds? I mean, when you say open your Bible, they say amen. They're ready. They're ready. Look at them. I know this is real blocking and tapping. This is real basic stuff. But I used to try to stare down people who looked mean at me. And I never changed one of them, and I just discouraged me. Really. Anyway, so I said, I'm not going to look at them. I'm going to look at the people who look like they're being blessed. The other folks, they'll just have to go figure it out somewhere. So I don't know if that gets at it or not. Yeah. Manuscript, none. Look at people as much as you can while you're preaching to them. And that's a thing where if you will write your own sermons, if you'll avoid that temptation to go to sermon.com at 9 o'clock on Saturday night, and work them up from the bottom up, that sermon is being enveloped in you all week. You don't have to memorize it. You've been putting it in you. And that's why I tell students, I say, if you will turn into an exegete, I'm not all that worried about things from their own if you want to preach, because you're going to be putting it in you all week long. And then you'll get from there to the sermon. Okay? Yeah, just don't start Saturday night. One of the misinfluences of Charles Spurgeon, I've heard it used sometime, is he started writing his sermon Saturday night after dinner at his house in South London. People say, well, Spurgeon started Saturday night. I've never been able to think of a good answer to that except one. Think what he would have been if he'd started on Monday. God only knows what would have happened if he'd worked on it all week. It was pretty good Saturday night, but there's only one of them every now and then. Well, we could go on like this all day. You're gracious and attentive. I think it's been a sufficient day in terms of what I've got to say, and I want to thank you for your attentiveness, for your presence. And let me say this about talking about preaching. Could I just say this and sit down? I always like to say it when I talk about preaching. Easiest thing in the world, stand up here and look like, Well, here's somebody who's got this thing mastered. He's got it down pat. And I don't say this in undue self-effacement. The apostle said we ought to think of ourselves accurately. But let me say this. For every sermon I write, it is a struggle. It is a fight to the finish before I go and preach it in the pulpit. In my 46th year of trying to do it, I don't know that I've ever felt like I had to work harder than right now. Now, you might say, oh, that's a counsel of despair. No, no, no. No, it's not a counsel of despair. It's just saying this is a lifelong task. I'm never concerned about the preacher who feels like this is a battle and it's hard and I don't know if I'm up to it. I am concerned about that preacher who's just too slick and stands up and says, well, I've got this thing down. No, it's a fight to the finish. But it's an awfully good finish if you can get there. Thank you very much. God bless you.